I'm supposed to talk about modeling the irradiated atmospheres of substellar objects. And we've heard a lot about the planets or substellar objects found in orbit around solar type stars, F, K, and M type stars. And I guess this is me. Some of you don't know who I am. And I'm working on this closely with Peter Hauschild and Franz Labarre. The general cartoon of the situation I've shown here in this roughly to scale drawing, you have something the size of the sun located very close to a tiny little thing the size of Jupiter at a very close distance, in this case 20 times closer than the Earth is to the sun. And it's receiving lots of radiation from its primary. So this has substantial effects on the upper atmosphere of the planet. So the idea is to model this and see what this thing is supposed to look like. I won't show you any comparisons of synthetic spectra to real spectra like Didier showed us, because fortunately for me there aren't any, so it doesn't look too embarrassing for me if it doesn't fit. So a little motivation. I apologize, we've had a lot of talks today, so some of this may be redundant. Here are some examples of what I'm trying to describe. Here we have the name of four systems. You've already seen these guys on a previous plot that Adam Burrows showed. Here's the star temperature, the distance from Earth to this system. The lower limit on the mass of the planet is given here. We only can say M sine I because we don't know the inclination of the orbit, except for one. I'll mention that in a second. And here's the orbital separation. So this is a distance from the primary to the primary in astronomical units. One astronomical unit is the distance from the Earth to the Sun. So basically, for all these things, this is all we know. We know they're there. We know a lower limit on their mass, and we know their orbital separation. That's not a whole lot of information. The only exception really is this one, which we've observed and we saw the data, some lovely data for the planet passing in front of the primary. And so we can nail down the mass, radius, mean density, and so we can say this is something like Jupiter. But for the rest, we don't know much beyond the fact that they're there. So we're waiting for observations.
You say a word about how you get the mean density?
Oh, well, you get the mass and the radius, assume a sphere.
Where do you get the radius?
From the observations.
Transit.
You saw...
Transit. Oh, right. Transit. Okay, right. That's fine. That's
yeah,
good.
You see this...
I understand.
The dip. Okay, so here I also put down GL876, which has a slight peculiarity because it's orbiting an M dwarf, a cooler primary. It's closer to the Earth, but it's at a fairly large separation. So we'd love to have
spectroscopy. You pointed out that that object now has a companion.
Right, it has a companion.
Another two.
And this, whoops. Yeah, and these, I believe these have fairly, the top three have fairly circular orbits, and I think this one has a fairly elliptical orbit, so, and it has a companion, so that's kind of complicated. Some of the things that we'd like to know that the spectroscopy could give us, velocities, radial velocities, rotational velocities, effective temperatures, densities, abundances, albedos, those kind of things. But we need to model the transfer of radiation through the atmosphere in great detail, and then have a synthetic spectrum like Didier showed us for the T-dwarfs, and then compare it to observations. But if you don't have observations, you can just show them to the observers and complain to them. The basic model atmosphere picture, no one I don't think has shown this. What does a model atmosphere look like in the computer? We have outer space here, center of planet or star down here. We break the atmosphere up into, you know, 50 or 100 plane parallel slabs. Each slab has some temperature, density, emissivity, and opacity, which is complicated function of the chemical composition. And we solve the rate of transfer equation at each depth along various rays that sample sample all directions. And we assume some symmetry about the symmetry axis. So the general model atmosphere problem is sort of summed up in this flow chart. We have some input, effective temperature, law of gravity, temporal composition, those kind of things. Solve the partial pressures for all the species present. Calculate some line continuum or molecular band opacity. Solve the rate of transfer equation at 100,000 to half a million frequency points. The output is something, we have a spectrum, an integrated flux. This has to satisfy basic energy conservation. Usually it doesn't, so we apply some temperature correction and start again with the new temperature structure, new pressure stratification. The whole cycle repeats itself until we satisfactorily conserve energy and have a self-consistent solution and out pops the synthetic spectrum. That's the basic plan. So for the models I'm going to show you, the basic situation, we have a plane parallel atmosphere. We sometimes do spherically symmetric atmospheres, but I'll save that for some other time. Assume hydrostatic and chemical equilibrium, convection with mixing link theory. The main difference in the cartoon that I showed you is that not only do you have some internal thermal pool of energy, we have the impinging radiations. We have two sources of energy to take into account. And then we have to satisfy energy conservation. So, right, exactly. Well, we model that as well. And you'll see what it looks like in a few minutes. But that's not a very complicated thing to do. So for the rate of transfer, usually for the objects that Didier Simon's modeling, the upper boundary condition is that the incoming rays are zero. But in this case, it's obviously not true. So we have to account for the incident flux, which is frequency dependent. And we set the incoming intensities at the surface based on this equation here, where the incident flux is given, diluted monochromatic flux from the primary here. R star is the radius of the primary, A is the orbital separation, and F mu is the frequency dependent flux from the primary. So these planets are probably very cool objects. So the equation of state, we have to include hundreds of molecules and dust species. So just to give you a sampling, it's always this kind of a freaky plot. Here's a 200 and something selected molecules that are included in the equation of state. There's about three times as many actually included. The ones highlighted in red are the more important opacity sources. You know, the other ones are important, even though they're very obscure and probably aren't very abundant. It's important to include a very complete mixture because more obscure ones can indirectly affect the species that are more important opacity sources.
Do these planets rotate? Are they tidally at all?
Well, the thought is that for like Tau Bu and 51 Peg, that they're tidally locked, but that's not an absolute certainty. Of course, some of them, you know, the farther out ones will certainly be rotating. So it's,
but doing 1D, so one side of the planet sees the star on the other side.
Right. So what I'll be modeling is, in my mind, a segment of the day side of the planet. Okay. In a 1D calculation.
So you're not just like assuming that you're not sort of trying to do a mean for the whole planet where you have like evenly distributed from one side to the other.
Well, that's an important question.
Pi r squared times the solar flux,
right,
with 4 pi r squared loss, or do you have just
exactly
the square loss?
In the equation, the 1/4 isn't there that you're talking about, but I can mention that later. I would prefer to, depending upon what Tristan Guyot and you come up with, how efficient the energy transport is around the surface, we can adjust for that. But personally, without knowing that, I think it's better to model the day side piece by piece. So adjusting the amount of radiation that the day side receives.
Well, except it's that you don't have the same energy balance actually, because exactly. You have some energy that is brought by advection or lost, actually. So your day side will be more out of thermal equilibrium in the sense that you
right.
Because you're removing some of the heat through advection.
Sure. Right, and this would show up, I think, as a variation in the effective temperature over the surface.
Yeah,
but actually, Charlie's point is correct. Step number one is difficult enough. Let's start with something.
Right.
But you can do it for the two endpoints, though, which would be useful.
Right. Definitely. I mean, these are issues that are turning in the back of my brain as we speak. So, and that's sort of why I'm here to talk with you guys about this.
Sure enough.
Yeah. Yes, time for dinner, right? Keep churning. So here it's a similar plot for the liquid and dust species that are included. Ones in red are the more important. This isn't by far all of the ones that are included, just to give you an idea of what weirdo things are included in the chemistry.
And you're not rating out the species to their
I'm getting, embedded. Getting to that. Okay, so next view graph.
Sorry.
That's okay. Predicting the future. It's always good. So again, important opacity sources, water, methane, collisionally induced absorption, dust grains. The models that I've constructed and that I'm about to talk about have been computed in two limits of the opacity. And this is the answer to your question. One case, which I call the Kond limit, where we have dust condensation in the atmosphere based on the chemical equilibrium equations. But we assume that the dust is completely rained out of the atmosphere. So this is a clear sky. So dust formation acts to deplete the atmosphere of important refractory elements and other opacity sources, but the dust itself doesn't contribute to the overall opacity. So it's just robbing the atmosphere of stuff. And the other case is a dusty case where, I think this has been mentioned before, where the dust just stays where it is. So we have a clear sky and a completely cloudy sky.
But I understand these are identical, except that you turn off the opacity of the grains in the condensation case. Right?
Well, not necessarily, because once the dust opacity is left, they'll have different structures. So they're not identical, because grain opacity is not present here. It has a strong effect on the temperature structure. But otherwise,
so the chemistry is otherwise the same.
Well, I wouldn't say that, because
the
chemical pathways are the same, but the chemistry depends on the temperature and pressure. Temperature and pressure depends on the opacity, so. But these are opposite ends of two extremes, neither of which is reality, as Mark Morley pointed out.
There's a slight physical inconsistency in that you're not really removing the grains from the chemical equilibrium. So you just turning off the opacity.
Right, that's right.
But for example, you could have iron forming and see the iron grains up in the atmosphere, and then they can react to form FES vapor, which shouldn't happen.
Right.
That's different from the Reynolds calculation.
Right. Yes. That's a good point.
It's very small.
But you do calculate the abundances of everything else. You don't rain out species and then do chemical equilibrium with what's left in the depleted atmospheres. You find out what there is, and then just don't use those refractory species in the opacity.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Exactly. Probably can do a little better.
Oh, of course. He's doing somewhat better anyway. Yes, we will definitely be doing better in the near future. So, okay, so the recent work that I've done is compute models in these two limits for a Jupiter-sized object with similar gravity at various orbital separations around two different primaries. So that big yellow ball is either going to be an M dwarf about 3,000 degrees, or a solar-like primary, 5,700 Kelvin. And we find big differences, as you might expect. So how am I doing for time?
We have
5 minutes? Okay.
You have
5 minutes. Okay, so maybe I'll be record in terms of short talk today. Okay, so here's the first one I'd like to show. This is for a planet with an effective temperature of 500 Kelvin, located near a 5700 Kelvin primary, a G2.
If you say 500 Kelvin effective temperature, you mean that's the inner boundary condition?
Well, that's the effective temperature of the planet in isolation.
Whatever that means.
Put it infinitely far away from the primary.
And
the effective temperature of that, I would say, is 500 Kelvin.
But you, how do you use that in the calculation? You have an inner boundary.
That's the internal thermal pool.
The fourth is the flux of energy from
right.
the intrinsic
flux. The intrinsic flux of the planet.
Yeah,
right.
That's an assumption. That's
right. That's a prescription of the model.
It's
a parameter.
How are you? Are you? Is the boundary condition such that you're forcing it to be convective? Is that 500 sigma t to the fourth? How does that come in at the bottom? What is the boundary condition that imposes that 500 at the bottom?
This is
a radiative flux.
Flux at the bottom. The intrinsic flux.
You force it to be convective at the bottom, I guess.
No, we don't. No, no, not at all.
No, it's like the flux coming in from the base is equal to sigma t 500.
Exactly. Yeah. I have a flashlight that pumps out sigma t effective to the fourth at the bottom, and then I have another flashlight on the top.
And the source function in principle.
Yeah, in source function.
Mine is just the actual number.
Yeah,
but
the details of how you do that, though, can affect. We're hearing Tristan's arguments about whether it's isothermal or not.
Right.
We can go into, I mean, there's actually another time scale, which is, I'm sorry, we get us half the time.
Well, I have 20 minutes, so. Yeah, I have some transparency. So on the left, we have the con case, and on the right, it's dusty. We have log T increasing this way. Gas pressure down here. This is outside. This is inside. In all the plots I'm going to show you, the dark blue curve will be the non-irradiated case. Solid lines refer to radiative zones. Dotted lines refer to convective regions. Tau equals 10 to the minus 4 optical depth, 10 to the minus 4 optical depth of 1, and an optical depth of 10. It's located here. So let me just talk about the con case first. You place the planet at 1 AU. You get this green curve. So you get some heating in the upper layers. And notice the suppression of the convection zone that you see here that was mentioned earlier. At half AU and then up to 0.3 AU, you get this red curve. And the convective zone is already pushed down to tau equals 50, so practically the bottom of the atmosphere. And notice that you have this con refers to a clear atmosphere, so the impinging radiation can reach the deeper layers. So the temperature structure is completely different at the bottom of the atmosphere. You have a different adiabat down here. In the dusty case, is a completely cloudy atmosphere, cloudiest day you can imagine. And the dust grains essentially allow only absorption of the impinging radiation field at the top of the atmosphere. Here at 0.3 AU, you see this nice inversion here, but notice nothing is happening to the interior. The dust simply shields the interior from the impinging radiation. So keep in mind that, you know, dusty models don't fit the cooler Baundorf regime, so clear models are generally preferred. So this is not, I wouldn't call this a realistic situation over here. This is an extreme. Reality probably lies more closely to the con case.
Okay. As you're changing that separation between the planet and the star, is the equivalent of the insulation, the total flux coming in, is that very roughly zoomed or square?
Right.
Question.
Oh.
No, yeah, it was just a comment on that last assertion. I would not be so sure about that. The fact that reality may be closer to the con model than the dusty model, because it really depends on how you transport grains and in an atmosphere heated by the star, it can be very different than for an isolated brown dwarf.
Well, from these models, I don't see a whole lot of change in the condensation based on these changes in the structure. There is some change, but it's not dramatic.
It
So, and what's forming, what's actually forming, what, you know, solid iron or incitite or frustrate, the concentrations aren't dramatically affected by the heating, actually.
Yes, but that's not right.
That's not what you're talking, I'm sorry.
At least all the observed EGPs so far, the ones close to the apparent stars, are much closer to the common model, I mean, to a common condition than to...
The Braunhofer.
No, EGPs,
right.
As a whole.
Oh, for example, the ones Maya, Rosa,
those are models. I'm talking of irradiated giant planets, extrasolar giant planets. So far, the ones which have been discovered are closer to conditions shown by Clarice for a Kohn model than for a dusty model, which would be much hotter.
It should be pointed out, of course, that if you have convection, then there's more of a chance of getting an extended cloud from the base. If you have a stellar insulation from the outside, it is much more radiative and you push the convective zone deeper in.
Sure.
Right. Under those circumstances, you still have gravity, so that the settling in the radiative case is probably more severe than in the convective case.
Right. But maybe what you're worried about is horizontal winds extreme weather phenomena that could exist at dredge and material. Right, that's certainly a possibility. Sorry.
I was just reacting to your statements.
Right. But until someone says, you know, there's going to be tornadoes and such things, hurricanes.
But putting this entirely locked, you might expect some completely absurd weather.
Because you imagine energy, you know,
yeah,
being rushed around the other side.
Huge flow of energy around the...
Right. So he can slap me on the wrist when he gets his talk.
Actually, I have a question. Presumably, to determine where the convective region is versus the radiative region, you just compared radiative equilibrium profile.
It's a Schwarzschild criterion, right?
So, what did you use for the dry adiabat? Like for the specific heat that you put into the dry adiabat?
I'm not exactly sure.
Because Tristan pointed out to me that at these temperatures and pressures, the dissociation of hydrogen could be important. And even if there's a little bit of dissociation, it's effectively a latent heat, which is quite large in the Earth's atmosphere.
Yeah. It's included. It's some of the equation I'm stating this.
I'm sorry, what?
It's our equation I'm stating this calculation. So the molecular dissociation is included in Peter and Franz.
Oh,
but
right.
Also in calculating the C sub P that goes into the
equation. Right. I thought you were looking for a number.
The adiabatic gradient is calculated with the Somerset equation.
So
they're going to
have up to a factor of 10 effect.
Okay, so next I'll show some spectra for the 0.3 AU case. First in the Kond limit. So we have log flux in millijanskis going this way, and wavelength from 0 to 3 microns. It's kind of low. The spectrum in red is the impinging radiation, the frequency-dependent flux that's coming in, the flashlight essentially at the top. And what's in blue is the flashlight at the bottom. And so the different components here are we have a purely reflected component, and then the thermal response in green from the planet. So if I allow the system to come to equilibrium and then turn off my external light, this part will completely disappear. And I'll have this green spectrum here. So notice the water bands and water methane mixtures here become a lot shallower. And I should point out the reflection in the Kond case, since there's no dust present, is all due to Rayleigh scattering off of H2 and helium, the two dominant species. So,
what's the separation of the planets?
Oh, this is the 0.3 AU case. So we see a significant amount of reflected light, but in comparison to the primary, it's still quite small. And we do see a significant increase in these bands that observers like to look at. So that's the Kond case. And the other extreme fairly similar behavior, but in this case, the reflection is all due to me scattering. So, and here's the very smooth thermal spectrum. Okay.
Is it obvious? There's a big difference.
Yeah, there's huge difference. Huge difference. And, you know, I personally believe the other one, though there might be some issues with that. But this is an extreme, even with the dredging up of condensates, I don't think this is going to be the realistic view, which is sort of fortunate. Well, it'll be unfortunate if it looks like this, because there's not many features to look for in observations. So that's... Yeah, exactly, except for this bump here, yeah.
Which is just the star.
Do what?
Which is just the star, more or less.
Well, right. That's... So, here again are the spectra at different separations. You can see what the at 1 AU and at half an AU, what that looks like. We can focus more on the cond case. So once again, this is all reflected, and then you have the thermal response here, and you can see the steady reduction of the water and methane bands, an increase in the J, H, and K bands. So, and as usual, the blue is the non-irradiated case. So if we look more closely at the reflected light, it's a sort of, maybe it's obvious, I don't know. Slightly different case. This is with a hotter planet, a hotter internal source. If we look at just the reflected light now, from 0.2 to 0.7 microns in the optical, in both cases. In the dusty case, all the reflection is due to Mie scattering, which is a fairly great process. So it's not too surprising that, as you said, what you get back is a copy of the incident flux. Slightly different out here. Oh, I should point out, these are heavily arbitrarily scaled just to match them. I mean, the black, which is the incident spectrum, is, you know, orders of magnitude brighter. So in the Mie scattering case, you get fairly good copy of the incident flux. In the cond case, where it's Rayleigh scattering, not too surprising, the frequency-dependent Rayleigh scattering totally screws up the reflected light. It looks totally different from the incident flux. In the regions where the recent observations of Tao Bu and of Charbonneau and Cameron et al, they observed, I think it was somewhere in this area here, and they assumed a dusty type atmosphere. So I sort of prefer this case. And so observations like those, where they're looking for a non-rotationally broadened a copy of the incident flux, you're not going to see that. Some of you aren't familiar with the observations, but what was done is for Tao Bu, since Tao Bu is thought to be tidally locked, the planet sees the stellar disk fixed, not rotating. But we see it spinning around rapidly, and so the spectrum is rotationally broadened. So we've got two variations of the primary light coming at us. One that's rotationally broadened and a reflected part that's not. So the thought was that you could sort of lift the non-rotationally broadened copy of the stellar spectrum that's varying periodically as the planet goes around out of the polluted starlight, star plus planet light. And so they looked for something like this case. But it's in the cond limit. Observations like that really need to know in advance what the spectrum looks like. They can't just assume that it's a copy of the stellar light. So maybe this was obvious, but I thought it was something that should be pointed out. Okay, and so I just have a couple more plots. Here's the case with the M dwarf. Similar plots before. Blue is the non-irradiated case. The internal flashlight has an effective temperature of 500 Kelvin. And down to, as you might expect, you don't see a whole lot of changes in the structure since you have such a fainter primary irradiating the atmosphere. And see a slight suppression of the convection zone, and also this is log temperature, so there is a difference here of which adiabat you have. Same as before, Jupiter radius and 3.5 log G. So this is supposed to look something like a GL876B system, but at a much closer separation. That one is something like 0.2 AU, so you're not going to see any irradiation effects in that object, but maybe if we find some more, you might see something. The spectra, not too surprising. Similar behavior as before. You don't see much very much reflected light in comparison to the primary, which you can't see. Here's the spectrum of the primary, what was used as the incident flux. You see the in both cases the planet retains its deep molecular features. So in these cases around M dwarfs, I suspect that they'll look pretty much as you would expect, and so these prominent features will be there for observers to look for. So okay, so how am I doing for time? I'm getting hungry. So, so here, kind of hiding some dark secrets. So here I have another one. You can't see, but it's hotter planet, a younger planet, effective temperature of 1,000 degrees. That's the internal source. And it's near a G2 primary, 5,700. So this is something I would say something like a Tau-Bu scenario. Here's the non-irradiated, and here we have the spectrum at 0.05, the structure at 0.05 AU. It's becoming nearly isothermal. A good part of the atmosphere. And you can see, again, the suppression of the convection zone. So so the spectra for that. Here are the spectra for that object. The red line is at 0.05 AU, and you can see that many of the features are gone, as you might expect for a the more isothermal the temperature structure, the less features you're going to see. It's not because these species are disappearing; it's simply the structure is flattening out. Interesting thing here: you look at the potassium, sodium, and potassium lines. They've almost completely disappeared. So the once extremely broad lines in the non-irradiated planet have almost completely disappeared at 0.05 AU. Not too exciting spectrum out in the far infrared.
Yeah, we're getting the same effect.
Same thing? Which is not great for people who want to observe in the infrared for these things. So sort of sad. But there's still lots of features in the optical, but that's not where it's brightest. Okay.
Actually, that's sort of a general comment to observers. What are the chances of actually being able to observe these objects, to say, just to get actually measure effective temperature or something like that?
Well, I think
they're so close.
Well, I think I don't think that I could be wrong, but I don't think coronagraphic observations are going to get us at 0.05 AU. So.
But they're not all at 0.05.
Right. Right.
Who knows how many there are in 3 AUs.
Right. Because there's a selection effect for that sort of thing. Right. So.
Point out the spectral deconvolution technique, which you referred to, the camera at all employed, and Charbonneau at all also tried to employ. It was done at sort of a low tech level, and they got within a few factors that they were able to see.
Right. So I think that's the way to go. I think
there are a couple of classes of of techniques like that that are cheap, that just require art and a lot of puzzle.
Right, right.
And what was the second?
This is a separation of the looking for the reflected light from the planet in the star plus planet. It's a very complicated process of subtracting, and you're looking for variations on the order of 10 to the minus 5 that you're lifting out, that you're trying to lift out of the star plus planet light.
But you can beat on another period.
Exactly. And you can look for a non-rotationally broadened copy. You sort of, well, not in the Kahn case.
And but there are also classes where if you just look at the centroid of the light, the principle that centroid will move as the planet orbits. And you don't have to distinguish between them if you can measure the centroid of the light really accurately. So it's another class of
light. In and out of some pan or something.
Yeah, you can.
Right.
Exactly to emphasize that.
We need the
formula. You don't need it.
No, you just
okay.
Don't need
that's the latest on this thing. Like
Tau Pu, like
there
had
been
a suggestion that
they
got detected.
They withdrew it.
Yeah.
They were intimidated by the theory.
Yeah, and for something like this, I get something like 10 to the minus 6 for, whereas Cameron et al. Reported something like 10 to the minus 4. So I'm getting something like two orders of magnitude less than what they reported.
10 to the minus 4. And now they have an upper limit around 3 or 4 times to the minus 5.
Which is exactly what the other guys, Charbonneau et al. Or
close to
that. Yeah. Okay, so.
Upper limit consistent with what you expect if they had a bigger radius.
It's consistent with the low albedos that we were calculating, but I'd like to reserve judgment for the next paper.
it's consistent with what I get, and since that. For a similar situation, you know, I did the calculations for the same wavelength range that they looked at, and compared. They were measuring a ratio of the incident, potentially the incident flux versus the reflected flux, and I get something like 10 to the minus 6. So they're reporting an upper limit of 3 or 4.
The albedos were low.
You're
looking.
You do it 10 to the minus 6.
No.
It's simply just a. I don't like. I hate albedos.
albedos.
Okay. It's a ratio of the incident flux versus the reflected flux.
Okay. The albedo that you were quoting, 10 to the minus 6, would be a few percent. And I think that an upper limit to the albedo is something like 10 to 15%.
Right. Right.
What is that ratio? You've got the internal thrust, right? Producing
energy
with some flux. What is that ratio? Typically.
Oh, for.
Figure of merit.
Do what?
Figure of merit.
Oh, you mean the comparison of the internal source versus the external source?
1.5, whatever there's kilowatts per square meter coming from the.
Yeah, and what is the internal source trying to pump out? They're comparable at these separations.
Yeah. It's much more than 1.5
kilowatts. Yeah. I mean, the sun pumps out, you know, like a lot of flux. So let me put in my summary. So, the end. Record time today, I think. So, not anymore? Oh, darn. Sorry. So, in summary, as you might expect for planets orbiting M-dwarfs, we don't see a whole lot of radiation effects, but there's still lots of broad features. There's still, planets should be very feature-full, which is good for observations. Planets around hotter stars will see large amounts of reflected light, and the molecular and atomic features are greatly altered, like the strong sodium and potassium lines that you see in the T and T dwarfs, like GL2 giant B, will be almost completely suppressed for something like Tau Pu. Reflected light, as I mentioned before, depends on essentially the how much dust is in the atmosphere. And it all boils down, in my mind, to what Tristan Guillot was brought up earlier. Is horizontal energy flow and weather effects. Mark Marley mentioned this as well. This strongly affects the irradiation effects. So how much energy is distributed from the night side to the day side, whether it's you can just take the incident energy and just globally average it. Those are all important questions, and people will get very different answers depending upon what you assume. So we really need to know whether it's cloudy, partly cloudy, or mostly sunny in my mind. So thanks. Okay.